that he was gave to as a slave gift. She must have been a wonderful person because he talked about her all the time. Always.
She taught him to read.
She taught him to read and to write. He never went to school in his life. These things I cherish. But also, my dad was a terrific fighter because he was mad at everything. He was mad because he was born in slavery. He was mad because he found out why, that his mother and father was mated like cattle. He was mad because he was too young for one war, and he was too old for the other that happened. And these are the things that they were saying, what you're fighting for. And he was for them all. But he fought for them alone. Like, if you are in power to carry a gun, so am I. He carried a gun for protection. For instance, like in the South, no white man ever knocked on a Negro's door to enter. They would just walk in. In the odd time, as a small kid, I'd always wash my father's feet when he came home from being on him so long during a day. I would always wash them. And I've known him many times. And he took his foot or his feet out of this foot tub when a white man entered the house and said, "Jeff," without knocking. He would go in, kick the door to, and say, "Knock before you enter. What do you think this is? A barn with cattle in it? We are people." My dad believed in fighting for that. He taught us how to fight for things like that. He, in a sense of speaking, in some instances, my father was very cruel towards things he didn't believe in. I mean, he didn't take the second thought about how to win it, or what to do about it, or go over there and get Sam and John and what you have you to help fight for it. He just did it on his own. I mean, it was his war and his family. And he felt like he was less than a man if he didn't protect his own family. And he believed one thing, that he was a man and he just protected his own family. And if you don't do it, if you have to say yes, sir, and no, sir, for everything and let people walk in and out of your house, regardless, just because you're Negro, well, you go ahead and let them do it, because I'm not. So it became a natural standard factor in the area where we live that don't go down there and bother old Jeff because he's crazy. But the thing was that my dad, I was at school, and this phrase was made by some of the kids. "Well, you know what everybody say, that your old daddy is crazy." I came back that evening, and I was talking to my dad about it. And I said, "These things are kind of hard to live with at school." So he told me a story. He said, you know, one time, when the railroads were first affected, he said, and I helped lay cross ties to put the railing in for the trains to move about on. He said, you've saw that, haven't you? And I said, yes. He said, well, there was a white man coming through to make a big speech. He said, and everybody gathered at where this little junction was going to be for the speech that this white man was going to make. And he says, of course, one Negro found a tree and sat down under it and fell asleep. And he said, when the train arrived, people cheered, and the Negro was sitting under this tree, asleep. And this man walked out at the rear on the platform. And he made a very fatundin speech, like, ladies and gentlemen, glad that I arrived. It was a wonderful trip. But the only thing, he said, that I have to say to you is one thing. What are we white people are going to do when that nigger wakes up and the train pulled away? And that was the big speech. These things my father resented very much. He knew at that particular time that the average person standing there then at the South going to the ruins after the Civil War, that we would be marching and singing today and not accomplishing anything. And that is the way he had to teach me to fight. He told me, never let anybody, just because of this or that, but be good at whatever you are. If you're gonna lie, be a good one. Never tell a lie unless it's airtight. If you're gonna lie and you feel like it's going to be a lie, which you know it is, don't tell a thousand lies to corral one. It's better to tell the truth in the first place. Then you won't have to tell a thousand lies to corral that first one that you told. These things I respected about my father. But I had to get a certain age, and I had to go through some of those experiences where there was some things that if you lied about, you shut up and say nothing. If you couldn't, or you felt like that you couldn't afford to expose somebody, people you don't hurt, but sometimes there's things that you should say, and a lot of times I never did, because it was destroying people. And I have watched people destroy other people. And it's disgusting when you watch the destruction of human beings from another just because. But you can't say that it isn't right to do. I don't like destroying people. I like, if I possibly can, to develop people or to help them. But I can imagine down to the light of myself that perhaps I have helped destroy people not knowing that I were. I got a breath.
I hate that sound.
Anyway, he talked me back to going to school that period of where I thought that you just wouldn't need to stand there all day because I had made people that would listen to me.
He wanted you to get an education.
Yeah. Anyway, I was sent away to school after a very bad thing happened in this little town that I had to live with, and I wasn't quite old enough to live with it. So they decided to send me, my dad did, to boarding school because this was in this little small community where everybody knows what everybody got for breakfast. All they have to do is to slide the window open and smell. The air is full of everything everybody's having. My mother washed and ironed for most of the white people in this little community. And they put my sister in this woman's house to cook and clean. And my sister was a very good cook, as same as my mother. So, night after night, by me being small, knew this man and not too susceptible of things, easily woken and a very big pretender. And I would hear this little atomizer. At that time I didn't know what it was, but it was making a little hissing noise. And everybody that was asleep slept sounder. Me, I would duck up under the pillow and hold it over my nose. I didn't know what it was, but it didn't like the odor of it. Then, first of all, I want to say he was a plantation owner that my father worked for. And then he would go to bed with my sister. And I suppose in between, by me coming out from under the covers, being a little nosy, I guess the stuff would get the better of me and I would fall asleep. And
I wouldn't know. Was it gas or something?
Ether.
Ether.
And I never would know when he left.
You mean he put everybody to sleep?
Yes. Then after a period of time, my sister was pregnant. And people use the word a broken leg around children when a young person was pregnant. They said that so much, and they would say that about my sister and me seeing her every day. I began having fights in school about her leg being broke because I would see her every day. And her leg was not broke, and I knew it wasn't. And I would notice my mother crying and crying and crying. And I would ask her, "Why are you crying?" And she would just say, "Shut up and go do your work." And I would go. But every day, I would have a fight in school about my sister's broke leg, to the extent of where I was expelled from school, not knowing why as of then. So finally, my father sent me away to school, to another school. When school was out, I came home. And I came home, to my great surprise. My sister was always kind of heavy, but she was heavier. But be it me, I thought maybe she was a big eater anyway, and I just thought, well, she just took on a few more pounds. The 10th of November, in 1920, the wind were blowing. It was no moon out, just the stars. And my mother was sending me after a doctor woman that had attended the same man's wife that had used the little hissing noise in our house for child's birth. I was very small. The dogs got after me. I had a lantern. I tripped. I fell. The lantern went out. I had no matches. So, me and the dark lantern went to this woman's house, and I told her, "My mother sent me after you because my sister is very sick." And she said, "Would you come?" She said, "No, I will not come and deliver that white baby." And I wondered, baby, if it is, how could she know what color it is? But anyway, her husband was a friend of my father's, and my father had went coon hunting that night. So he made her go. So she came. My sister was in such pain, she yelled out to me to pray for her. And I remember running in, kneeling on my knees, and beginning to say the Lord's Prayer, which that was about all we were taught to say. And later, in the morning, I was put to bed in the loft which they called upstairs, but it was never finished. And I heard a baby cry. And somehow or other, I fell asleep after I heard the baby cry. And the next morning, when I came downstairs, this lady and my mother were sitting at the table drinking coffee, and my sister was asleep, and there was a little light baby. My father came home from hunting, and there was the baby. The baby was two months old, and this doctor that this midwife worked with came over and says, "I got to send in something to the state that a child was born out of wedlock. What are you going to name it?" Nobody had a name. Nobody thought of none. And my father didn't say anything. So he said, "Oh, well, that's all right. Say he looks like a little titty. And I'll call him Titty." He was a year old by the name of Titty. He had no other name. So finally one day, my mother got very angry with my father because it was a tradition in the family that my father named all of the children. That was a court tradition. So my dad remembered his father, and then nobody in the family had his name. And he said, "His name is Jim." And somebody questioned him about Jim, and he said it means James, but you can call him Jim for short. But the name had worn with him as Teddy. And nobody ever referred to him as Jim, but my father. After that, my sister would refuse to do anything for him. So that naturally adapted me. I was the one and my mother that looked after him. So finally, we began to tell her about her responsibility, so she decided, "Well, I'll give him away." And my mother didn't want that.
Did they ever know who was the father?
Yes.
They did.
I had to live with this in skew. I had to fight about it. And I also had to fight her battles. Then I went to the post office one day. The child is almost 4 months old. I went to the post office. It was a postmiss, not a postman. It was a lady by the name of Miss Trenton. She said, you tell that sister of yours that we having a meeting today, all of us white women, and that she better not come around these two stores anymore. Because if they do, if she does, we going to beat the daylights out of her about our men. And I said, yes, ma'am, I'll tell her. But I was mad enough to reach and pull her through that little small window that they have in most post offices. On the way back, knowing who I was, there happened to be a one-eyed man lived in a town by the name of Lucas. He had, at that time, we called them cotton heads, but later I learned they were blondes, but we called them little cottonhead patties. They had a big black dog, and they hissed this dog on me, and I killed him, because I carried a dagger that was made out of a file with a handle on it, a leather handle, that I learned to wrap and also braid whips, bull whips, with my father. And I killed this dog. For a minute, it surprised me, because with the dog's raging, and when he raised to attack me, the dog was taller than I. And that is why I got a chance to stab him real good. But this time I was so angry, I didn't think to take the dagger out. I kept right on cutting. The poor thing fell dead in a lump. The little kid ran. By this time, we had to leave this little town. Because of the viciousness of me, and every inch of my father to defend me. And this meant nothing but either hanging, a plain suicide. So my dad packed and left. He always hated that, because he said he ran, and he never liked running from a fight. If he was right, hold your ground. And if you run, you know you must run. And he always felt like he was right. This always bothered him. So we went to another little place. He was very easily hired by people because of his experience and knowledge of stock, building, and also of farming and how to raise things. So we were there, and we set up farming. He had his own little corn patch, everything. There was a man lived not very far from us. It was stock law in the state of Arkansas. You had to have a fence up around the particular path that you was cultivating But anyway, this particular man would leave his stock out at night and open our gate because he didn't like my dad. Because news traveled over 150 miles, and I don't think we were that far. If we were, it wasn't much farther. So my dad would tell him, would you please keep your stock out of my fields? All that they don't eat up, they destroy. But this man, being a white poor farmer, as well as my dad was, a Negro poor farmer, he just said, you try and make me. So we'd chase his stock away every morning that have destroyed about 1.5 acres of our production of what we were raising. So finally my dad went to him and told him, I'm not going to ask you anymore. If they in there in the morning, I'm not going to open the gate because they didn't. But they're going to get out and I'm not opening the gate. So that particular morning, about 4 or 5:30, we were always up. My mother was cooking breakfast and my father went out to check the stock and around the little surroundings we had, which he always did. And he came in the house and he got the shotgun. And there were 2 mules. And he went out and I heard the shotgun blast. And of course, the mule jumped the fence with the rear end full of buckshot. My dad and all of us went to the table. My dad blessed the table as usual. We were just finished eating when this gentleman came and challenged my dad and said, you're going to pay for that mule, Jeff. My dad said, if I pay for that mule, you are going to pay for the damage that he'd done to my crops. So in the argument, I don't know how this happened, not as of now, but they got in a little scrummage in the backyard, and my dad bit the corner of his ear off, and he bit my dad's nose. So that ended that little village of where we lived. On we go again to another place. Somehow, by the age of 12, up until now, I never remembered a happy day. I just live and I look at other people being happy. But from the age of 12, I can never remember being ever happy. All I can remember is fight, resentment, pretend, don't do this. If you do, have an agreement with yourself that you're going to do it just the length of time. When the time run out, stop. That's how I know, perhaps, that I've hurt other people or helped destroy them. These things I notice about myself, because it was always a fight. You never could depend on being anywhere any length of time unless you fought. And if you fought, there was no room for you anymore in that little particular place. You either had to refight or keep on fighting, or for peace sake, you leave. May I rest?
Want to go out and take a ride?
Yeah.
Is there a... Kaiser, Arkansas. Mm-hmm. Was that where you got your land that you later, that you lived on the rest of the time? Your 1,200 acres or whatever it was?
Yeah.
Was that around there?
No, it's the Kaiser.
Oh. And you were about, how old were you then?
I was, 17.
Oh. You were 17.
Mm-hmm. 17 years. I was expecting a baby.
Is this after you met your... what was his name?
Yes. Jerry.
Jerry. Yeah. Were you going to tell something about that? About his family and...
There's not too much to tell about his family because...
Well, you took them all, so...
Well, after my... this episode in Kaiser, and my father and mother left because I was the last of the family, child, and I was married, and they left and left me the farm.
You and Jerry and all those children, though. And you
were that was my own. That was before.
Oh.
I went to have the child, and I went to Memphis for a delivery of my baby. In the meantime, he was in. Competent. You couldn't trust him. So he wouldn't prepare anything. And I had to be there for a while. So consequently in this, he ran away. Mm. And white people come in and simply took over the house, confiscated everything. I never knew why. And so it was out of that.
Mm-hmm.
And then we went to his parents. And this is where I lived until his mother became ill with this tumor. And of course, she went to Memphis for this operation, and at that particular time, blood transfusions, they were appropriated, but they wasn't using them because of, I don't know why they weren't, but that's what she died from, was the need of a blood transfusion. And this is where I took up the raising of his family. And by this time, I was only about 19. And when she died, I was 19. And I finished raising her family, including mine. While we lived like that for a period of, I'll say, she died in 1928, the 12th of February. And this went on until 1930s. I can't remember exactly what year, but it was in the 30s. I left and went to Indiana, where my people were, because I hadn't saw them in 15 years. I left and I went there, and over a period of about a year, he came. He didn't like Indiana, and he left, and he went back to the South. And then after a period of time, I went back, and I told him I was not going to raise my children in the South. I just couldn't see raising my children in the South, and I said, I'm not going to. So with that, I left hitchhiking and tagged my kids and sent them to Indiana on a bus. I got some rides, but I had to stop and work because I knew that my mother wouldn't know my children if they arrived, and this disturbed me very much, and I'm behind. But I had wrote a letter and explained to her that I was on the way, and these were my children.
How many were there?
Two. I know she wouldn't know them because she, the last time she saw the older was only 10 months old, and by this time it was 10 years old, and I know she wouldn't know my children. So I stopped and I worked. I earned some money. Well, this was in Gary, Indiana, and I took a bus, and they were delayed in Chicago for some unknown reason. I don't know. But anyway, I arrived the same day they did.
Where had they been?
I don't know. They might have fell asleep in Chicago and missed their bus. I don't know, and had a stayover. So anyway, I got there the same day they did, and I was very disturbed when I arrived, when my children weren't there. I went out to the bus depot. I was questioning everybody. I was practically frantic. And a bus come in, and it was unloading. And I seen these two little children getting off with these tags on them, and I knew they were mine. And this guy tried to keep me from the gate. And I ran on past him anyway and claimed my children like they were luggage. And when I came back, he said they had to come in the depot anyway. And he said, you could have stood here. We weren't going to buy them. Well, I mean, that was beside the point. I had stopped and worked, and I got there before they did, and I had sent them ahead of me, and I couldn't figure out why they weren't there. And I thought, Well, if I go to this bus depot and they don't arrive, I am going to walk back to Chicago and find out what happened to those two children, because the traveling aid there told me that they would be safe. Anyway, we got there. My husband went back to the south. I stayed there a while, and I left my kids there with my mother, and I went back. And in the meantime, we were going through this government business of getting rid of the land, I mean, something off the land, and they called it parody. And that was some out of what the government had taken away from you, because the markets were flooded with cotton, soybeans, wheat, and corn. And they called it parody.
Yeah,
but,
I remember that parody.
And in the meantime, we went back. We got to pay for this. And I went back to Indiana, and he came to Minnesota. And then...
Why'd you come here? Did you have some knowledge?
Yeah. He knowed some people here, which was the Perrys. In the fields, so he came here. So he began after me about bringing the children and coming here. And he couldn't get a job, but they were hiring women. But he couldn't get a job. A man couldn't get a job any kind of way. Well, I know then what it was. It was for stability. He was lost without somebody to depend on. So I was working in Indiana. So I managed to save $65. So I worked up until bus time that night before I left in order to have money to eat on. Here. And I had two customers to serve because I worked in a restaurant, and I almost missed my train, my bus. The kids were on the bus and they saw me running to get on the bus, and they went to yelling, "There comes my mama, wait." My mama was running. So we held the bus till I got there. And they said, I thought we were going to have to go off and leave you again. They were so accustomed to that. So we all got here together on a bus. I was very disgusted when I reached Minnesota.
Was it winter?
No. It was the 18th day of August.
I remember dates like that.
I was a southerner. The climate was different. People was dying of heat here because it was terrifically hot that year to everybody else here but me. And the next morning, I was walking down the street with a coat on. And somebody laughed, and my husband said, "You should take that coat off." And I said, "I'm not going to do it because I'm freezing. I don't care who's fainting." I promised myself I will not live here because we can't afford it. It's too cold. But I got stuck. I was here 3 days, I got a job.
What doing?
I was working at Montgomery Ward's as a maid. And I worked there a month. And I quit. And he got very furious with me about quitting because he couldn't get a job, and here I had a job, and I would quit. And he couldn't figure it out. Then I got a job on Eagleheart, working in a resident home. But after I was there, I found out later what kind of place it was. It was a call girl place. But the only thing that myself and another girl did was served dinner parties and drinks and cleaned up their rooms and checked to see that window shades and things were down for these people that would come there and stay for 2 or 3 days. I worked there for, I suppose, about 2 years, because I took a like to the lady. She was very nice to me, and I think she liked me quite a bit. But she became ill and in and out of the hospitals. I couldn't go under the strain of which I had to go under there. Because this other Negro girl that worked there, she was a head girl, and she was very arrogant. And her customers were falling off because of her. And
she was running it after?
Yeah. Well, when this lady would come home, she would want me to tell what happened. And I was, in a way, I was afraid of her. I was afraid of this woman, because she had an awful temper. And I didn't mind fighting, but I didn't like fighting. And because...